somewhere, somewhere. Prabhupada's room. Who was at the reading in Prabhupada's room? We'll just continue where we left off. Om Agyantam Anandasya Ginangina Shalakaya Chaksar Militam Jinatas Maya Sigurdavinam. Friday, June 2nd. Today I held initiations in the courtyard of the temple. I accepted two boys as disciples, 17 and 23 years of age. Because they are Sankirtan partners, I called them Nakula Das and Sahadev Das, after the twin sons of Madri, the wives of Pandu. Beside a crowd of 300 devotees, many of them congregation members, I think it's okay like this. Yeah. There were a number of people from the neighborhood. There also must have been 50 Muslim children. And during the 2.5-hour kirtan that Sri Prahlad led, afterwards they chanted Hare Krishna and danced in ecstasy as their parents looked on from the rooftops or over the walls of our temple. It always amazes me to see Muslims intermingling freely with the devotees and attending our functions. The temple is situated in an area where the houses are packed closely together, but no one seems to mind our kirtans. However, every morning when Govinda Maharaj or I give Srimad Bhagavatam class, the local mosque, just 50 meters away, inevitably blasts the reading from the Quran over its loudspeaker to the area's Muslims. Can we elevate that a little? The devotees attending class simply move in a little closer to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam speaker. Before taking rest, a devotee brought us our passports. He had managed to get visas for us from a government office with a bribe on the side. Now we were legally in the country and could legally leave as well. It was a great relief for us. Tomorrow night we plan to fly further into Central Asia, to Bishkek on the border of northern China. As I fall asleep, I curse the mosquitoes. There is no relief from them, especially because in Azerbaijan and Russia you cannot buy mosquito repellent. It doesn't exist. For me, it's the most amazing thing. I searched shop after shop for mosquito repellent the other day until Uttama Shloka told me that Russians don't even know what it is. Saturday, June 3rd. This morning I gave class on a verse from the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam about the glories of the Brahminical or priestly order. I was emphasizing the point that by becoming a devotee of the Lord, a Vaishnava, one naturally develops the good qualities of a Brahmin. I then gave the example that Haridas Thakur was born in a low-class family as a Muslim. Immediately upon saying this, I felt uncomfortable because almost all the guests were Muslims. It wasn't the proper choice of words according to time and circumstance. I immediately tried to adjust the mistake by quoting the verse from Bhagavad Gita, which states that those of low birth can approach the supreme destination. Mamhi partha vipastritya yepisu papayonaha Shriya Vaishyastatashudras Tepiyanti Param Gatim. O son of Prita, those who take shelter of me, though they be of lower birth, women, merchants, and sudras, can attain the supreme destination. But of course the verse didn't mention Muslims, so I didn't completely succeed in adjusting the awkward moment. A preacher must become expert at preaching according to time and circumstance, so as not to offend anyone and inspire his audience towards devotional service. Later this morning, Sri Prahlad and I, with one other devotee, went into Baku to find a park to chant our rounds. While driving around, we came across a beautiful mosque that was under construction. Out of curiosity, we stopped and got out to look. We were surprised to see that it was being built entirely from solid pieces of rock and marble, like buildings of previous centuries. The small crew of men working on the construction at the front section of the mosque were chipping away at a piece of flat stone that appeared to be for an intricate window frame. They approached us and asked us where we were from and what religion we were practicing. After some discussion about the Quran and Bhagavad Gita, they invited us to come inside the mosque. At first I hesitated because I feared that if any militant Muslims saw us in the mosque, we might have problems. Several years ago, when there was agitation in India over the Hindus tearing down a mosque in Ayodhya, local Muslims in Baku surrounded our temple and threatened to burn it to the ground. The devotees called the temple in Moscow. where they immediately went on calm, appealing for international help. A few hours later, a flood of protests swamped the Azerbaijan government from devotees and well-wishers throughout the world, and soon the Baku police came and dispersed the mob that was surrounding our temple. Calm key. At the insistence of the workers, we went inside, and they took us all the way to the top of the mosque by way of the stairs and one of the turrets. At the top, we had a bird's-eye view of the entire city. At one point, Sri Prahlad turned to me and said he was also feeling nervous being in the mosque due to a few people gathering and watching us from the street. So we thanked our hosts and descended the stairs back to our car. That evening, we held our final program in the Baku temple. At the end of the last kirtan, I gave a little talk thanking the devotees for their wonderful association and encouraging them in their preaching. I told them Srila Prabhupada must be very proud of them for the determined preaching in this part of the world. Srila Prabhupada once said he would take the dust of the feet of any devotee who preached in a Muslim country. As I looked out at the Baku devotees, tears streaming down their faces, I could understand that many of them must have been placed there by Lord Chaitanya to fulfill his desires for spreading the glories of the holy names in every town and village. All glories to the devotees of the Baku Yatra. May they be blessed with the full mercy of Haridas Thakur. Sunday, June 4th. We left Baku for Bishkek at 3 a.m. on Azerbaijani Airlines. In the CIS, flights operate around the clock. The four-hour flight took us past Afghanistan and India into Kyrgyzstan. The airplane was quite old, and it appeared it had never been cleaned. It was typical of planes in the CIS. Inside, they are more like buses. No drinks or refreshments are served, and no one asks you to buckle your seatbelt. I can only imagine how much attention is given to the mechanical parts of the plane. Once Srila Prabhupada said that the external condition reflects the internal state. If that is true, then no doubt flying in the CIS is very risky. I'm sure there are crashes, but the policy is that they are never reported. Binod Bihari told me that on his way to join us, he boarded an Aeroflot flight in Odessa bound for Moscow. Just as they were taking off, the right engine caught fire. The plane screeched to a stop, and all the passengers fled the plane. The fire was extinguished and the engine replaced, and in 3 hours they were off again in the same plane. Upon our arrival in Bishkek, we were met by 40 devotees of the Yatra. Being so close to China, most of them are of Oriental appearance. The only senior devotees to have ever visited this place are Gopal Krishna Maharaj and Govinda Maharaj, so the devotees were leaping in ecstasy to see us. We went to the temple for a short darshan. As one particularly blissful old woman came forward to offer me flowers, I noticed a large blue tattoo on her arm, which read 46123. I asked the temple president why she had such a strange tattoo, and he replied that she was a prisoner in one of Hitler's death camps in World War II. I thought, how fortunate she is to have survived to get the mercy of Lord Chaitanya 50 years later. After the reception, I was whisked away to a radio program downtown. When I arrived at the radio station, I realized what a big preaching opportunity was at hand. The radio station was one of the biggest and most popular in Bishkek. The disc jockeys loved the devotees who bring them prasadam every day. When I walked in, they told me I could do whatever I wanted for 3 hours. The studio was mine. They said more than 500,000 people would be listening intently. So I called the temple and told the devotees to tell Govinda Maharaj and Sri Prahlad to get down to the station in 45 minutes before we went on air. They arrived just before the program began. Suddenly the mic was in my hands, and we were on the air. We started a kirtan, and after a few minutes I announced through a devotee translator, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is Indraduma Swami, and I'll be your host for the next 3 hours for a transcendental journey to the wonderful world of Hare Krishna." Myself, Govinda Maharaj, and Sri Prahlad spoke and answered questions that came in over the hotline. At the end, we had a big kirtan, and all the DJs and their assistants were dancing around the studio in ecstasy. Monday, June 5. This afternoon, we had a big Harinam in downtown Bishkek. The devotees had worked hard to get permission, so they were really eager to chant and dance. The public, being Oriental and thus quite reserved, didn't chant or dance with us, but looked on respectively and asked some nice questions. Before going to sleep, I told Govinda Maharaj about the bad dreams I'd been having since the big initiation in St. Petersburg on Lord Nrsingadev's appearance day. He told me that Shivaram Maharaj often has dreams of a spiritual nature. So I fell asleep thinking of Shivaram Maharaj and had a wonderful dream about him. I dreamt that myself, Govinda Maharaj, and Shivaram Maharaj were installing Radhakrishna deities on the new Bajadam farm in Hungary. Shivaram Maharaj actually plans to install such deities there on Janmashtami 1996. In my dream, after the installation, the curtain closed for the pujaris to dress their lordships. When the curtain opened again, Srimati Radharani had a beautiful, radiant smile on her face. Shivaram Maharaj fainted in ecstasy, and I caught him as he fell to the ground. Shivaram Maharaj ki. Tuesday, June 6th. While brushing my teeth this morning, one of my teeth fell out. I took it as a sign that at 46, I'm not getting any younger. Srila Prabhupada says in the Srimad Bhagavatam that old age begins at 50. I also heard a lecture tape recently of Srila Prabhupada in New York City in 1969, where he said, this body is no longer young, like a young man's body. As soon as you are 50 years old, old age begins. And when you are 70 years, you are completely old. I suppose if I'd taken things easier throughout my life, my body would be in much better shape than it is now. But I have no regrets. As the Bhagavatam says, what is the value of a long life inexperienced by years in this world? Better one moment of full consciousness, for that begins one on the path of perfection. Being a traveling preacher is a very demanding service and takes every ounce of one's energy. Chanaka Pandit says, a garment becomes old by being left in the sun. A horse becomes old by being left tied up. A woman becomes old from lack of attention from her husband, and travel brings old age upon a man. But despite the difficulties, the happiness in being a traveling preacher is unlimited. Not because one gets to see the world, I've seen enough of that, but because it is an opportunity to please Srila Prabhupada by completely devoting one's body, mind, and words to his mission. Srila Prabhupada wrote to Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj in London in January 1973, quote, I can understand that it is not an easy manner to travel extensively over long periods of time without proper food, rest, and sometimes it must be very cold there also. And still, because you are getting so much enjoyment, spiritual enjoyment from it, it seems like play to you. This is advanced stage of spiritual life, never attained even by great yogis and so-called jnanis. But let any man see our devotees working so hard for Krishna, and let anyone say that they are not better than millions of so-called yogis and transcendentalists. That is my challenge. Because you are rightly understanding through your personal realization this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, in such a short time, you have surpassed all the stages of yoga process to come to the highest point of surrendering to Krishna. That I very much appreciate. Thank you very much for helping me in this way. Unquote. This morning, I gave a lecture to 100 university students, and in the afternoon, I lectured to 300 people at a public program, some of them from the university program. During Govinda Maharaj's question and answer session, I did a television interview for the biggest television network in Kyrgyzstan. They had heard last night's radio program and came to film our lecture program. This evening I gave a lecture at a devotee's apartment where Govinda Maharaj installed Gornitai deities. The day was packed full of preaching programs from morning to night. Oh Prabhupada, how happy I am to serve you like this, always preaching and traveling on. As a flowing river remains always clean, I pray to remain always pure. Vyas Puja offering 1990. Wednesday, June 7th. Beginning early this morning, we drove 11 hours from Bishkek to Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, passing briefly through Kazakhstan. It was a long and arduous journey through 800 kilometers of arid land. One compensation was the snow-capped Himalayan mountains that remained always to our left for most of the journey. There was not one petrol station the entire 800 kilometers. You either bring your own petrol or buy from the old petrol tankers that park intermittently along the route. At one point, we found a crystal-clear river coming down from the mountains and stopped and bathed for an hour. It was a welcome relief from the sweltering heat. We arrived in Tashkent at 10:30 p.m. The devotees had been waiting for a visit for more than a week due to our travel plans having been adjusted several times. When our car pulled up in front of the temple, the devotees exploded into an amazing kirtan that swept us into the small temple room. After Guru Puja, Govinda Maharaj and I spoke, thanking the devotees for the reception and telling them how much we look forward to the next few days with them. The temple is a simple building in a residential district on the outskirts of Tashkent. The devotees struggle to maintain it. They are able to collect only $100 American a month, and that must go for all their expenses. I simply couldn't understand how they survived. But people in this part of the world are tough and enterprising, and so the devotees go on. They have even started a small restaurant here, although on their income I couldn't understand how. But the temple president said that everything in the restaurant, the small storefront itself, wood for redecorating, kitchen equipment, and plates and coultry, was donated by friends and well-wishers, even Muslim neighbors. The Uzbekistan government is very strict regarding all religious movements. No one, neither the predominant Muslims, the minority Christians, nor ourselves, is allowed to proselytize in any way, means, or manner. Because the government fears the fundamentalist Muslims who have taken control in countries to the south like Afghanistan, we are not allowed to do any Harinam or public programs. So our stay in Tashkent is simply to be with the devotees and the congregation in the temple. The first Mughal invasion of India originated in Uzbekistan. 1,000 years ago, the conqueror Muhammad Ghazi left from Samarkand, a city to the west of Tashkent, with a massive army to conquer India. When he reached the outskirts of Mathura, he marveled at its majesty and beauty. He is quoted as saying, "In all my imagination, I could never have dreamed of such an opulent and beautiful city." Then he ordered his army to level Mathura to the ground. After destroying the city, its deities, and most of the population, he took all the gold and riches back to Uzbekistan. It was the beginning of Islam's long domination of India. Thursday, June 8. After the morning program, I went with Sri Prahlad into Tashkent to buy a few necessities. I was still looking for a tube of insect repellent. We went to the biggest market where the upper-class people shop. Shopping in the market was not easy, for the reason that everyone who saw us stopped us out of curiosity to speak to us. They were polite and respectful, but their many questions made it impossible for us to do any shopping. After 1 hour, we had only made it 20 meters into the store. The products in the market looked like something out of the 1950s in America, and I couldn't even find insect repellent. What I would give for some good repellent! I remember the king in Shakespeare's Richard III, who, falling from his horse in the crucial battle for his throne, cried out, "A horse, a kingdom for my horse." Friday, June 9th. Being Pandava Nirjal Ekadasi, I decided to observe the full fast, even from water. It wasn't easy because we were in the desert, and somehow there often seems to be many complications on Ekadasi, and this one was to be no exception. I received a calm message early this morning that the temple presidents in South Africa were considering postponing the annual December Rath Yatra in Durban until April. Their reasoning was that the Rath Yatra interferes with the December book marathon. I was angry about a move to switch plans in mid-year and jeopardize such a big preaching program. After last year's Rath Yatra, we discussed the pros and cons of changing the dates and decided to keep it in December. But recently, someone again agitated the situation, and the desire to change was further expressed. I feel protective of the festival because when Srila Prabhupada visited Durban in 1975, he told the devotees to build a beautiful temple and hold a big Rath Yatra every year. It wasn't until 1989, when I was temple president in Durban, that we succeeded in holding the first Rath Yatra, and it was an overwhelming success, which has increased every year since. To change to April is risky for a number of reasons. It's not the festive season like December. It's subsequently more difficult to collect funds in April, and we may not get permission for our regular site. I personally feel the real issue is that the devotees in Durban are not fully into the book marathon in December and are using the Rath Yatra as a straw man philosophy. But I feel practically helpless to do anything from Central Asia. It's difficult to get out of Tashkent or Uzbekistan by phone or comm, and it's expensive. After hours of trying, I managed to contact Bhakti Charu Maharaj by telephone. I also managed to call Shuddha Kirti, the temple president in Durban. I have a long-standing friendship and admiration for Shuddha, and appealed to him to go ahead with the plans to hold Rath Yatra in December. He said it would be discussed during the weekend. In an effort to find a solution that would be acceptable to everyone concerned, I offered to take charge of the December book marathon, as well as the Ratha Yatra. Most of the Ekadasi, I paced the floors in the sweltering heat, praying to Lord Jagannath to let the festival go on as planned. More bad news came this afternoon. When Binod Bihari went to the office to buy train tickets for our next destination, Dushanbe in Tajikistan, he was told we were all in Uzbekistan illegally because we didn't have visas. It was like a bad dream all over again. We had driven into the country, but no one stopped us at the border from Kazakhstan to Uzbekistan. The rules are still so unclear in these former Soviet republics. Bureaucracy is slow, moving, and laws change from day to day. But it appeared we definitely needed visas. So Binod Bihari had to resort to our previous tactics in Baku. He was led to a friend, quote, who could help him in a dark, smoky office at the back of the train station. There he produced some American dollars and got a special stamp put in our passports. They weren't even stamps, just some writing. It is supposed to be enough, but we won't really know until we reach the border. Getting to Dushanbe is not going to be easy. Islamic fundamentalist rebels are fighting government forces in the countryside, so we cannot fly into Tajikistan from Tashkent, and the trains are diverted to safe passageways that change all the time according to the fighting. Nothing is sure or certain. Besides that, the devotees say that the train ride is literally a slow-moving train to hell. The toilets are never cleaned and the windows are boarded up as protection from any bullets. Our only real possibility is to drive to Dushanbe, but it's a 14-hour drive through territory held by the rebels. Although the devotees say the rebels probably won't stop us, I'm a bit nervous about the idea. They also told me that the border guards are known for taking some, quote, help in the form of money or anything they like from one's bags. What's more, the road is simply a dirt road etched out of the mountainside with room for only one car to pass. Once again, we are faced with a decision to go and give association to devotees who rarely see any senior devotees and who are preaching under difficult situations, or to play it safe. We decided to go. The problem was that we had only one vehicle, so Govinda Maharaj called all his disciples together and asked them to go out and try to find a car that would take us through Samarkand and down to Dushanbe. It was not an attractive proposal. Driving through rebel territory into an uneasy situation in Dushanbe. But Maharaj's disciples rushed off, eager to please him, and 4 hours later came back with several choices. An army jeep, an old Russian Volga, a Polish Nissan van, and a 1970 Mercedes. We chose the Mercedes, with his professional driver named Boris, not because we wanted to go in style, but because it was the safest vehicle out of the four. This afternoon, myself and Govinda Maharaj did an interview with the biggest TV station in Tashkent. Having been told we couldn't proselytize our faith in Uzbekistan, it wasn't clear to me how I was supposed to do a major TV interview. But the interviewer gave me a list of questions, and then I understood how it was possible. Most of the questions were based around yoga, but as the interview went on, Maharaj and myself began to speak freely about Krishna consciousness, its history, traditions, and philosophy. No one objected, and the TV personnel were thrilled with the program, which they said would be aired on Saturday at prime time. I took the whole thing as Krishna's mystic power. This evening, Govinda Maharaj gave Bhagavad Gita class at the Tashkent temple. He began with the Jayarada Madhava prayers, but as he kept going, the kirtan got bigger and bigger. Finally, he got off the Vyasasana, and we had a 2.5-hour kirtan that lasted until 10 p.m., With more than 200 guests and devotees, we took the kirtan out in front of the temple, but no further. Many Muslim neighbors came out of their homes to see, and cars and buses stopped to watch. We had quite a crowd, and everyone was pleased. We may have been a different religion, but everyone enjoyed seeing us chanting and dancing Hare Krishna. Soon a number of neighbors were chanting with us. Again, I marveled at how Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan transcends all barriers of birth, nationality, and religion. It is completely transcendental. After the kirtan, all 200 of us, plus many neighbors, sat cramped on the small pathway into the temple as myself, Govinda Maharaj, Sri Prahlad, Binod Bihari, and Uttama Shloka took turns preaching and reminiscing about our visit. Govinda Maharaj told the story of how Lord Chaitanya defeated the Muslim Chan Kazi, who was initially opposed to the Sankirtan movement. After discussing with Lord Chaitanya, the Chankazi allowed the Sankirtan of the holy names to continue throughout Navadvip and requested all further generations of Muslims to permit the chanting of Hare Krishna to go on in that area. As Maharaj pointed out, the first Muslims to invade and settle in India were from Uzbekistan, so this is where the Chankazi's ancestors must have come from. Maharaj prayed that one day the Uzbekistan government would also honor the order made by the Chankazi of Navadvip to Lord Chaitanya and allow us the freedom to chant the holy names without restriction throughout the land. Sri Prahlad's final kirtan again brought a flood of tears from the devotees as we said our final goodbyes. In Nectar of Devotion, Srila Prabhupada says that a devotee must learn the art of crying for Krishna. Quote, in other words, one should learn how to cry for the Lord. One should learn the small technique, and he should be very eager and actually cry to become engaged in some particular type of service. This is called lolium, and such tears are the price for the highest perfection. Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 9. This is possible only by the mercy of the Sankirtan movement. On our way back to our apartment at midnight, we were stopped at a police roadblock. But when they saw we were Hare Krishna devotees, they laughed and waved us on. But the next car wasn't so fortunate. I saw the driver had to give the police a bottle of Russian vodka before they would let him go. Govinda Maharaj told me that last year while crossing the border into this country, his servant had to give his watch to the customs official in order to be allowed in. Saturday, June 10th. We left Tashkent this morning for Samarkand. As we were driving, Yasomati Nandanadas, the regional secretary for this area, told me that in the 19th century, all the Muslim countries in this area, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, were actually one country called Turkmenistan, with the Emir of Bukhara, now Uzbekistan, as the absolute authority. The country was fabulously rich from its invasions throughout the centuries. After the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917, the Emir of Bukhara, fearing a communist takeover of his country, had his soldiers put all the gold in the treasury on a caravan of camels and take it into the desert to hide it. Then he had those soldiers killed, and those soldiers who killed those soldiers killed, and those soldiers who killed those soldiers killed, until he was the only one who knew where the treasure was. But he died without revealing its location. We looked for it. We couldn't. Our trip to Samarkand, one of the prominent capitals of ancient Islam, took 4 hours through dry farmland. We passed many irrigation ditches where young boys could be seen happily swimming in the sweltering heat. I saw that much of the farming was done by Muslim women in colorful traditional dress. Bundles of wheat were being transported to the nearby villages on small donkeys. It is said that visiting Samarkand thrice is equal to visiting Mecca once. Approaching the city, a famous quote I had memorized in my school days suddenly came to my mind. For the joy of knowing what may not be known, we take the golden road to Samarkand. As we entered the city, we saw many ancient and beautiful mosques, and being one of the 5 times of the day that Muslims pray, we heard the mullahs reading the Quran through the loudspeakers atop the mosques. Men were kneeling in prayer here and there. I was awed by the size and beauty of many of the buildings, although some were in disrepair. Dating back more than 2,500 years, Samarkand was once called the Pearl of the Muslim World. We had several hours before our program with the local devotees began, so we decided to visit some of the historic sites. We saw the tomb of Timur, the Mughal tyrant, who swept into India after Muhammad Ghazi and conquered Delhi. Outside his massive and ornately decorated tomb is a huge marble seat where he received guests. Nearby is a large stone vat about 3 meters in diameter. I asked one of the guards what it was. He said Timur would have each of his men in his army pour a cup of wine into the vessel before going into battle. When they returned from fighting, they would again take their cups and dip one time into the vessel and drink. By seeing how much wine was left in the vessel, Timur could judge how many of his men had been killed in battle. We saw his actual tomb beneath the ground. Because he was one of the Mughal tyrants who conquered India, my thoughts while there are difficult for me to put into this diary. Just outside Samarkand, we visited the tomb of Saint Daniel, the great Christian who was untouched when thrown to the lions in the Colosseum by the Romans. I asked Yasomati Nandana why St. Daniel was buried in Uzbekistan. He told me that Timur, the tyrant, had tried for many years to conquer Syria, but was unsuccessful. One of his ministers suggested it was because the saint from biblical times, Daniel, was entombed there. Timur then sent his army to where Saint Daniel was entombed in Syria, and after a fierce fight with the Syrians, was able to take his body back to Uzbekistan. It is said that Saint Daniel was 18 meters long, and it required a caravan of camels to transport his remains to Uzbekistan. And his tomb is 18 meters long. When we saw his tomb, I was surprised that it was indeed 18 meters long. The caretaker of the tomb is a kind and gentle Muslim man who told us that worshippers from many religions, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, visit the tomb. He requested that we circumambulate the tomb to pay our respects. Then he asked us to sit down, and with great devotion he began reciting the Quran before the tomb. He was such a simple and kind man that his prayers moved me a lot. He told us that once he was sleeping next to the tomb and Saint Daniel appeared to him. Saint Daniel told him, "Get up, my child, get up. Guests are coming to visit." Govinda Maharaj, who was so impressed, took a broom and swept the entrance to the tomb, as he said, to do some seva for Daniel. Before leaving, we drank water, said to have power to cure, from a natural source that had sprung up the day Saint Daniel was entombed there. Dusk was setting in by the time we reached the park where the program was to begin. Remembering that proselytizing was strictly against the law in Uzbekistan, I was again bewildered how we were to present a program in a public park in a Muslim country. But when we arrived, I understood how the devotees had arranged it. They had heard that Sri Prahlad was the lead singer in our rock band Celibate Lovers in Poland, so they had simply advertised the program in the park as a rock concert. When we arrived, the caretaker of the park was a bit taken aback by our dhotis and shaved heads. But as soon as Sri Prahlad started kirtan with his accordion, everything was all right. About 100 people gathered as soon as Sri Prahlad started to sing. I was standing there, again marveling at how we were chanting Hare Krishna in Samarkand, the ancient pearl of the Muslim world. As Sri Prahlad began, I thought to myself, "This one's for all the Kshatriyas who fell in battle defending the city of Delhi. Roll over, Timur." Sunday, June 11th. After a short morning program with the 20 devotees of the Samarkand Yatra, we left in two cars for the city of Dushanbe in Tajikistan, which borders Afghanistan. Boris's yellow Mercedes led the way with Govinda Maharaj and four of the devotees inside. The rest of us followed in another car. Considering the dangers of traveling to the mountains, we decided to take a longer route that was less risky. The further south we drove, the hotter it got. We stopped to get petrol at the first petrol station that I had seen in Uzbekistan. The men at the station brought out a strange contraption that mixed petrol with oil. After mixing the substances, they poured the petrol by hand into our gas tank. It took half an hour to fill a tank of each car. About an hour after filling up, one of the red lights on our car's dashboard lit up, and our driver, Alexander, pulled over to the side of the road. Taking a screwdriver and wrench, he jumped out, opened the hood of the car, and cleared the gas lines in the engine. He said the petrol we took was of such poor quality that it had blocked the gas lines. It was a good thing he knew how to fix cars. Otherwise, what in the world would we do if we broke down in the desert of Uzbekistan? Boris, who drove trucks through this area for 25 years, told us that at night, if you stop at the side of the road and leave your headlights on, thousands of tarantulas will come out from the desert onto the road attracted by the light. He also said that some of the most deadly scorpions and snakes in the world are in this region. It took us 11 hours to reach the Tajikistan border. After passing through three checkpoints on the Uzbekistan side, we had to pass another three border controls on the Tajikistan side. As we came to the first checkpoint on the Tajikistan side, four soldiers approached our car, each carrying an AK-47. In the process of searching our cars for weapons, one soldier found my money belt, which I had stupidly left in the glove compartment. Opening it, he found several $100 I was keeping there. It was a tense moment. He asked me why I was carrying so much money, and I replied it was to help our Food for Life program in Dushanbe. I explained that we give free food to people who are in need there because of the war. He seemed to appreciate that, and with a sly smile, gave me back my money belt. We were questioned and held for half an hour at each of the other two checkpoints. At the last checkpoint, one of the border guards told Boris that we were lucky we were coming into Dushanbe from this direction. He said that 50 kilometers on the other side of the city, a battle was raging between government forces and rebels. But be prepared to duck bullets from either side as you enter the city, he said. We were all a bit tense, and I chanted some Nisshringa prayers as we drove from Dushanbe, 30 kilometers away. Then, the most amazing thing happened. About 3 kilometers from the border, as we were passing through a village, we saw a huge Muslim wedding ceremony taking place. It was 9 p.m. at night, and all the villagers were singing and dancing in an illuminated field. A small band was playing traditional Islamic music, and there were several rows of tables where men and women in Muslim dress were feasting. The bride and the groom sat with their relatives at a table on one side of the field, and many people, young and old, were dancing for their pleasure. It was a very joyful and colorful scene. As we passed by, I thought, it would really be interesting to visit that ceremony. Prabhupada said, you have to be a little crazy to join this movement. Just at that moment, Govinda Maharaj's car stopped. He's the craziest of all. Ahead of us, and he jumped out and came back to our car. He said, Maharaj, what do you think? Let's go down there. I said, okay, let's go. And we walked down to the field with the rest of the devotees. We had no idea how we were going to be received, but we had always been warmly and kindly treated by the Islamic people, so we had no fear. And just as we expected, as soon as the people saw us, they welcomed us with traditional Muslim gesture. They go like this. A hand to their heart, and with big smiles and slaps on our backs, they swept us forward to sit with the men at the tables. When they offered us food, we politely refused, saying we were Hindustani mullahs, observing our own kind of Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting. Respectfully, they just gave us water. After a few minutes of discussion with the elders of the village, they asked us to lead the singing. Uttama Shloka ran back to the cars and got our mridanga, kartals, and Sri Prahlad's accordion. The leading men of the village then took us to where the musicians were playing and introduced us to the crowd of 2,000 villagers over an antique loudspeaker system. I spoke through a translator for a few minutes, thanking the villagers for receiving us so warmly. When I mentioned that we felt part of the family, a huge roar of approval came from the crowd. Then we began kirtan. At first the people watched us with curious faces, the men with their big mustaches and the women and girls with their heads covered by scarves. Then suddenly, one by one, men and women came out of the field and danced with us. It was an incredible scene, Muslims and Hindus dancing together like best of friends. After 15 minutes of kirtan, we were all given seats of respect with the elders of the village. They again tried to feed us meat and vodka, but we again pleaded that we were observing a fast. Then the local band played again, and hundreds of people came forward to dance in a traditional Islamic style. The leaders requested we must also dance. At that moment, to refuse would have been seen as a great offense, so we got up and danced just like them. A few minutes later, the crowd roared for us to sing Hare Krishna again. So Sri Prahlad and Govinda Maharaj sang over the loudspeakers. Myself, Uttama Shloka, Binod Bihari, and Krishna Prasad danced on the field. At one point, we approached the bride and groom at their table of honor. They stood up and respectively received us, and the groom's friends all shook our hands. The bride's face was completely covered, so I couldn't see her. Just as we were getting ready to leave, the village elders came and insisted that we go to another festival 5 kilometers away. By now it was 10 p.m., but we agreed to go again because if we refused, it would be seen as disrespectful. Besides, it was a rare chance to spread the glories of chanting Hare Krishna in the Muslim world, so off we went. As we were driving to the next village, Govinda Maharaj got a little nervous and said they could take us anywhere and do anything they wanted with us. However, a few minutes later, we arrived at the next festival, which turned out to be the celebration of a new boy's circumcision. The whole village was there enjoying the singing and dancing, and we were once again met with hearty approval and applause by the people, many of whom must have never seen foreigners before. The village children simply gaped at us. Soon we were having another big kirtan as people came forward to dance, and there I was again, watching in amazement at the modern-day miracles of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes unfolding. And everywhere in a Muslim country torn apart by civil war, a battle raging only a few kilometers away, yet chanting in unabated happiness with the people of a remote village. Who could ever imagine? What miracles are to be seen for those who serve the mission of Lord Chaitanya within this world? O Srila Prabhupada, please give me the privilege to serve you like this, birth after birth. We arrived at the Dushanbe Temple at 1:30 a.m., passing through four more police checkpoints on the way. At each checkpoint, the police were nervous because of the battle on the other side of the city, but each time they let us pass, recognizing us as some sort of holy men. Monday, June 12th. Totally exhausted from yesterday's activities, we slept until 7:30. Later, I went with Temple Presidents Sabuti Roy and Govindamraj in a car to chant our rounds in the city. Just after we entered the city's main street, a car drove by us and gunfire started coming from the windows. On the other side of the street, a man dove to the ground to avoid the bullets. The sound of gunfire startled me, and I saw many people ducking for cover. We decided it would be better to chant our rounds at the temple, although Sabuti Roy said that recently a car bomb exploded next to the temple, and on several occasions the temple has been sprayed with machine gun fire. The Dushanbe Temple is the nicest I've seen in the CIS. Situated in woods high above the city, it gives a panoramic view of Dushanbe. The devotees told me that when the war was at its peak in 1992, the year ISKCON was registered here, they watched from the balcony of the temple as rockets flew from the nearby hills into the city. The government has been refusing to acknowledge our movement, but then a rebel missile destroyed a government building, killing the people inside who were refusing to register us. The devotees applied again, and then they were registered. During the 8 months the Muslim fundamentalists controlled Tajikistan in 1992, the devotees bought the temple for $500 American from the previous owner, who had to flee the country. To date, the war has taken 100,000 lives. The fundamentalists have been pushed back into nearby Afghanistan and Pakistan, but continue to infiltrate the country and create havoc. But there's a silver lining for our devotees. Tajikistan's pro-communist government likes us. Fearing a fundamentalist Muslim takeover, the government tries to encourage other religions in the country. It supports our daily Food for Life prasadam distribution in downtown Dushanbe. Before taking rest, Govindamraj told me that the pain he has had in his back for many months has practically disappeared after bathing in the waters of the natural spring near St. Daniel's tomb. I mentioned to him that the pain in my ankle from an injury I received a year ago had also disappeared as well. I'm not professing a miracle, just stating the facts. Maybe it's a coincidence. Tuesday, June 13th. While leaving Tajikistan today, the customs official at the airport requested us to have kirtan. We are not allowed to do Harinam on the streets because of the war, but somehow they had heard about our kirtans at the temple. So right there in the customs hall, with people waiting to have their passports, stamps, and bags cleared, we got our instruments out. We always travel with Prahlad's accordion in my mridanga, and had a 10-minute ecstatic kirtan. The officials were in bliss, laughing and clapping and dancing, and when suddenly the airline people came running towards us, saying that we were holding up the plane. When we arrived in Almaty, Kazakhstan, 2.5 hours later, the customs officials there were making a thorough search of everyone's baggage. But when they saw us, they just waved us through. I couldn't understand why until I met the devotees who were there to receive us. They had gone into the customs hall before our arrival and distributed delicious prasadam to all the officials, thus facilitating our entry into the country. I was thinking how in the material world people rarely show kindness to others unless it's in their own interest to do so. So when devotees show causeless mercy to people, it touches their hearts like nothing else. Pulling up at our apartment, incense was literally billowing out of the upstairs window, permeating the area around the building with sweet smell. Anyone walking within 50 meters had to smell it. Sri Prahlad told me that Radhacharan Prabhu, who had become a devotee as a result of a similar situation. He had been walking in the area of the Paris temple one afternoon and had smelled the sweet odor of incense. It was so attractive that he followed the scent to the temple. He had never seen or met devotees before. The door to the temple was open, and he just walked into the temple room where the incense was burning. There he met devotees, and that was the beginning of his spiritual life, much like the four Kumaras. In the evening, I lectured on the life of Shyamananda Pandit. He has always been one of my favorite heroes in Krishna consciousness. Although he was such an advanced devotee, experiencing the highest mellows of devotional service, he was also a powerful and bold preacher, just like Srila Prabhupada. Wednesday, June 14th. News came from South Africa that they were still debating, postponing Rath Yatra. I had spent much of today trying to contact them to no avail. I'm in such anxiety that I've fallen ill as a result. This evening, the local Gurukul children put on a performance for me in their school apartment. I was enchanted with the music. They performed some very sweet bhajans with the guitar, harmonium, and flute. To some degree, it mitigated my anxiety about the Durban Rath Yatra. Thursday, June 15th. We had a wonderful Harinam in downtown Almaty. There are no laws forbidding chanting in the streets here. The people loved it. One middle-aged woman stopped to watch us with the rest of the crowd assembled around us. I was speaking to the crowd at the time, and when I asked them to repeat the Hare Krishna mantra, the woman responded very enthusiastically. At the end, I asked her to come forward, and in front of the whole crowd, I gave her my thick red rose garland. She was overwhelmed. During the next kirtan, she came forward and started dancing with us. That encouraged others to come forward, and soon we had about 15 to 20 people dancing wildly with us. It was wonderful. Friday, June 16. I awoke exhausted with a bad headache and didn't know how I was going to do any service today. I considered taking some aspirin. I don't generally do brands on the market in Russia. On the way to an initiation ceremony I was to do in Almaty that morning, I mentioned to Sri Prahlad that I felt better, but a little groggy. He smiled and said that he'd put aspirin in my juice, because he couldn't stand to see me suffering. He knew I had a big day ahead of me. When I realized that that was why the juice had tasted so bad, we started laughing together uncontrollably. The initiation ceremony was held in a public park. It appeared we might have to cancel it due to rain, but the skies cleared long enough to have the four-hour program. As soon as we finished it, showered again. I initiated one girl, Vrinda Devi Dasi, who has a severe heart problem and may not live much longer. Immediately after initiation, I went for a TV interview with Govinda Maharaj. We spoke for 20 minutes on national television to an audience estimated at more than 1 million people. After the interview, we held a public program. Like in Bishkek, Govinda Maharaj had me give the talk, and then we answered the questions together for more than an hour. This evening we were entertained again by the Almaty Gurukul, bhajan and dances. I could easily understand how in Vedic culture, families and villages would come together for such evening programs after a hard day's work. The mind is stimulated to higher thoughts, and the soul is enlivened. Nowadays, families gather in front of the TV to watch horrible programs that do their thinking for them and pollute their hearts. Before taking rest, I went on calm and received news from Moscow that a FSK KGB agent who had been planted in our temple had become a real devotee through association. He admitted that he had been placed in the temple to oversee our activities, but the life and philosophy of the movement had changed him. The day after he made his confession, there was an attempt to assassinate him. He's now in the hospital, but more determined than ever to become a devotee. He confirmed our suspicion that a crackdown on our movement is coming soon, although he said there are definitely people in important positions within the government who do support us. I sometimes wonder if the KGB would make an attempt on the life of a foreign preacher like myself, or arrange for a, quote, accident. It's certainly not impossible, and is a sobering thought. But they would have to take into consideration the following verse from the Sri Nisringa Kavacha of the Brahma Samhita Trailoka Vijaya. Ugram viram mahavishnum jalantam sabatomukam sringam vishanam badram mittur mittum namamyaham. I bow down before the all-powerful, frightening, auspicious, sublimely ferocious Nisringa, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, who burns like fire, whose faces are everywhere, and who is the death of death. I also heard that as part of the World Children's Day in Moscow Red Square, the devotees brought a 2-ton cake to feed the city's hungry children who were attending the celebration. Many important groups and dignitaries were there, and we received favorable coverage on TV and in the newspapers. Top officials from the Russian Orthodox Church were invited, but when they heard the Hare Krishnas were going to be there, many refused to come. When those who did come saw the cake, they declared the whole function had become polluted. Sunday, June 17th. Before leaving Almaty, Sri Guru Charna Padmadasi, one of my disciples, who had just arrived back from India, told me an interesting story. While in Vrindavan, she had met one of the devotee ladies who had traveled with me up the Amazon River 7 years ago on the boat. At that time, we had encouraged many Amazon Indians in the villages to chant Hare Krishna. The lady told Sri Guru Charna Padma that devotees had gone back to these villages recently in another boat, and she'd had the opportunity to go with them. In one remote village, they had found a young man, perhaps 16 years of age, who had run forward with tears in his eyes when he saw the devotees entering the village. Embracing them, he said he had been faithfully chanting Hare Krishna on beads every day for 7 years. He began looking around anxiously for that tall, fair-skinned man in saffron robes who had given me the beads 7 years ago. Hearing the story, I suddenly remembered the boy. We had been staying in his village for 2 days. At that time, he must have only been 9 years old. He was particularly attracted to us and had been asking me how he could join us. I told him it was impossible, but I gave him an extra set of beads that I had and taught him how to chant. I told him to chant 16 rounds a day. He promised me he would and would wait for the day I returned. Krishna has arranged for the devotees to return to that village. The lady said the boy was devastated that I wasn't there. Hearing the story, my heart pained and I longed to go back there immediately. This afternoon, we traveled 3 hours by plane to Novosibirsk in Siberia. Descending from the plane, we were met by cool winds of the tundra, a big change from the hot deserts of Central Asia. We were nervous as we approached Russian customs and immigration. Myself, Govinda Maharaj, and Sri Prahlad had our multiple entry one-year visas ready, but Krishna Prasad's visa was not actually valid. He had initially come into Russia on a single-entry visa, and that had terminated when we left Russia to go to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Having no alternative, Govinda Maharaj decided to try to get him back in on the same visa. It seemed like an impossible dream to me. As we approached immigration, we all put our passports and visas together, with Krishna Prasad's Nepalese passport and his expired Russian visa on the bottom. When the immigration officials saw us, they were shocked, presumably because foreigners rarely enter Russia through Novosibirsk. But suddenly, here we were, two Americans, one New Zealander, a Nepalese, and our Russian helpers, all in dhotis with shaved heads. It created a big stir. A number of officials came over and made a show of demanding our passports and asking us all sorts of questions. It was a tense moment, and it didn't look as though they were going to let even those of us with valid visas in. But then Govinda Maharaj, undaunted as usual in such situations, and not the least intimidated by the aggressive officials, started joking with them. He has demonstrated again and again a unique ability to make friends with anyone and everyone. As soon as he puts his big grin on his face and starts joking with the officials in his Tennessee drawl, the defense breaks down and they are drawn to him. It's like magic and always works. As his humor makes them smile, he slaps them on the back, and suddenly the officials are like old friends that will do anything for him. This time it also worked. The officials systematically went through our papers, starting with Sri Prahlad and myself. Maharaj started up, and by the time the officials got to Krishna Prasad's papers, they hardly looked at them. They just smiled, stamped his passport, and let him through, all due to the magical charm of Govinda Maharaj. We exited immigrations and customs to a reception of 100 blissful devotees. Among them, there were many children, eyes and hearts fixed on me. It always amazes me that wherever I go, there are often children waiting to see me, whom I had never seen before, but who seem to know me. As we approached the assembly of devotees, one eight-year-old child approached me and stood next to me as we accepted garlands and flowers from the devotees. At one point, he looked up and said, "You like kids, right?" The spontaneous devotion reminded me of an incident with Srila Prabhupada in 1975 in New Mayapur, France. Srila Prabhupada was visiting our farm community, and one afternoon I was carrying my son, Gorshakti, who was only 2 or 3 years old at that time, around the chateau on my shoulders. Suddenly, Srila Prabhupada appeared at the window of his room on the second floor. Seeing him, Gorshakti called out, "Srila Prabhupada! Srila Prabhupada! Srila Prabhupada!" Prabhupada smiled at him and waved. That evening in Darshan, Srila Prabhupada commented on the incident and remarked how the children of the community have so much affection for him, although he had never met them. The Novosibirsk temple is an old kindergarten building with ample facilities for the devotees. They worked hard to secure the building, but it appears they may soon lose it. President Yeltsin recently signed a decree that buildings erected by the communist government as kindergartens must be used solely for that purpose. The devotees are considering opening a Hare Krishna kindergarten in the part of the building. There are about 100 devotees in the yatra, actively preaching throughout Siberia with book distribution and food for life centers. This evening we had a 3-hour kirtan in the temple room, leaving no time for class. While preparing to take rest, I encountered the Siberian summer mosquitoes, as big as houses. I practically fainted when I saw them, but God's grace was upon me. A devotee had just returned from India and gave me a tube of Odomos Indian insect repellent. To me, it was worth its weight in gold. Sunday, June 18th. Today I was faced with a decision whether to go back to Poland when our tour finishes on June 24th or to stay a few more days to give association to my disciples in Moscow, many of whom couldn't come to my Vyasa Puja celebrations in St. Petersburg. By going back to Poland as scheduled, I'll get a chance to attend to my correspondence. There are many letters from disciples around the world waiting to be answered, and if there's any extra time, I could get some rest before our summer Polish festival tour begins. It's one of the most demanding tours of the year, but the disciples in Moscow are begging me to come and spend a few days with them. My intelligence tells me to go back to Poland and rest, but my heart tells me to stay on in Moscow. I gave class this morning to an eager and receptive audience. The devotees don't get much association on the tundra of Siberia, so they relish every moment of nectar they are given. I met my disciples throughout the day, and this evening we had a 4-hour kirtan. Just before taking rest, I received good news. The leaders of the South African Yatra, after considering my arguments for holding this year's Ratha Yatra in December, agreed to go ahead as planned. The deciding factor seemed to be my offer to lead the book marathon from the Durban Temple during November and December. I was relieved, and I wondered if it was all Krishna's trick to get me into the book marathon. I distributed books for France in France for 12 years, from 1971 to 1983. How much I enjoyed that service. And when I look back on those years, I see how important they were in my development in Krishna consciousness. Most of what I utilize in my service as a sannyasi and spiritual master, I learned from distributing books for so many years. Book distribution is definitely the best training a devotee can get. One remains detached from material life by constantly seeing the temporary miserable nature of the material world, while at the same time developing his faith in Krishna consciousness by daily witnessing the extraordinary mercy of Lord Chaitanya upon the fallen conditioned souls, and by having to defeat opposing arguments and convince others to take up spiritual life, one becomes a capable preacher. Sometimes I long for the simple life of being a book distributor, but then I see my present responsibilities as an opportunity to inspire others to distribute books and obtain the same benefits I had. But if my higher authority suddenly ordered me, "Now go back on book distribution," I would have no regrets. I know exactly what villages I would go back to in France, exactly what streets and stores I would go to. But now it seems Krishna is fulfilling that desire by giving me an opportunity to help organize the book marathon in Durban. My mind is already full of plans and ideas. My only prayer is that the Lord will allow me to keep body and soul together. Generally, the Ratha Yatra takes all my material and spiritual resolve. But if my disciples in South Africa help me, I think I can do it. Monday, June 19th. I spent most of the day giving darshans to my disciples. For many of them, it was the first time they'd ever spoken to their spiritual master. One young lady, Madhu Priyadasi, told me an interesting story. She had come to my Vyasa Puja celebration in St. Petersburg, 5,000 kilometers from her temple here in Novosibirsk. Being a young Brahmacharini, she has little, if any, Lakshmi at all. The temple was unable to pay her fare, so she was in complete anxiety. But she was determined that somehow or other she would get to the festival 5,000 kilometers away. So with two of her god sisters, Vishnu Shakti and Vaijayanti Mala, she went to the local military airport and asked to speak to the commanding officer. Surprisingly, she was allowed to see him, and she begged that he allow them to fly to St. Petersburg on a military airplane. The commanding officer couldn't believe his ears. But after an hour of preaching to him, he somehow agreed, and that afternoon they hitched a ride in the luggage compartment of a military cargo plane en route to St. Petersburg. Only in Russia something like this could happen. I asked her how they got back to Siberia, and she said they had preached to several St. Petersburg businessmen on the street who agreed to pay their way. Man proposes and God disposes. This afternoon I went for a chapel walk in the park. The whole area looked as though it had been abandoned for years. In fact, most of Novosibirsk looks like this. As the economic situation in Russia deteriorates, the cities look more and more grim. There seems to be nothing beautiful in terms of buildings, parks, roadways, or housing in this country, and everything is getting worse. Of course, such situations are good for preaching, so one tolerates the austerities. There were many mosquitoes in the park, and I watched with amusement how people dealt with them. They were tearing small branches from trees and bushes and swatting themselves continuously to keep the pests away. I was happy I had my mosquito cream. Tuesday, June 20th. Today we flew from Siberia to Chelyabinsk in central Russia. Late for the flight, the devotee driving us was speeding and taking risks by weaving in and out of the traffic. This was breaking one of my cardinal rules to my disciples, to drive safely and cautiously under all circumstances. We never think how dangerous it is to ride in a moving vehicle. Even if we are driving carefully, there are always so many people on the road who are not. Therefore, I forbid my disciples to chant japa, eat, or engage in extended conversations while driving. They should concentrate on the road as their immediate devotional service and observe the speed limit. And if they get tired, they should pull over and take some rest. Although I asked the devotee several times to slow down and take it easy, he didn't heed my instructions. We arrived at the airport on time, but I was counting my blessings. We had an evening program at Chelyabinsk in a rented hall. I was exhausted from the travel, but tried to remain fresh and alert, because I knew many of my disciples were seeing me for the one and only time of the year. As Krishna's representative, I had to speak and present the absolute truth to ensure their faith in Guru and Krishna and give them strength for the many months that we would be separated. There was no time for being tired. We had kirtan, and Govinda Maharaj and I spoke. I lectured for more than an hour, elaborating on Srila Prabhupada's perfect formula for expanding this movement. Preaching is the essence, books are the basis, utility is the principle, and purity is the force. Wednesday, June 21st. I gave class this morning on the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. If I think of the activities I appreciate the most in Krishna consciousness at this point of my advancement, I would have to say they are doing kirtan and giving Bhagavatam class. Delivering the perfect wisdom of Srimad Bhagavatam by Srila Prabhupada's grace is an important duty and responsibility for all preachers, and a pleasure as well. This afternoon we went on Harinam Sankirtan. As our car approached our prearranged meeting point, I saw more than 200 devotees in the midst of a blissful kirtan. But I also noted an ominous sign. There were 4 police vans parked alongside the kirtan party. I asked Uttama Shloka what was going on, and he explained that the police had suddenly taken a new attitude towards us. Up to a month ago, they were very friendly and accommodating, but Uttama Shloka speculated they had recently received some instructions from higher up and were being more strict with us. I again felt the vice closing tighter on our movement. The police cars escorted our Harinam through a desolate part of town, but when we said we wanted to chant in the center of the city, our requests fell on deaf ears. After an hour, we managed to convince them to let us chant near the corner of a fairly large and populated street corner where we drew a large crowd. Just off to one side were a group of young boys and girls performing breakdancing with their ghetto blasters. We invited them to breakdance to our kirtan, and the performances drew an even larger crowd. It was an interesting combination. At one point, they asked to dance to the music of one of their tapes, saying we would like it. I agreed, and they put on the tape of a top band in Russia singing Hare Krishna. They had worked out a dance routine that all of us, devotees and those in the crowd, appreciated very much. June 22nd, Thursday. I spent several hours meeting my disciples. Because there were more than 40 disciples to see, I had to limit each darshan to 5 minutes. It was difficult. Each of them desired to have as much personal association with their spiritual master as possible. Although we often say that the Vani, the spiritual master's instructions, are more important than the Vapu, the personal association of the spiritual master, Every devotee knows that in order to fully appreciate and assimilate the instructions of his spiritual master, personal association is important. It is for that reason Prabhupada once said he was traveling all over the world just to give association to my disciples. During the darshans, I had to listen carefully to each of my disciples and give the appropriate encouragement, chastisement, or instruction. I had to choose each word and sentence carefully, knowing that whatever I said would be the guiding light for each disciple for days, months, or even years to come. Personally, I know that the few sentences that Srila Prabhupada said to me remain fresh within my mind after 25 years and are pertinent instructions in many circumstances. I cherish his few words to me and keep them like veritable jewels within my heart. They are the source of unlimited strength and inspiration at all times. Don't sleep in my classes. They are simply fools and rascals, attached to the bodily concept of life. No good qualities. What do you think, Indradumna? Come on, take prasadam. And of course, the words that give the greatest hope in my life. So much endeavor in this material world, but when I take you back to Godhead, everything will be easy and sublime. Thank you, Srila Prabhupada. Please give me the purity, the strength, and the intelligence to guide my own disciples to your lotus feet. Throughout the darshans, I found myself quoting from Srila Prabhupada again and again that the spiritual master teaches his disciples the basic principles of devotional service, and the disciple must learn to execute the details. I said this because very often disciples would ask for practical solutions to marriage problems, business problems, health problems, etc. Although I give guidance in these matters, I feel it is important for the disciples to mature and be able to make Krishna-conscious decisions for themselves. If that is not always possible, then they should learn to take help from the temple authorities, senior devotees, or godbrothers and godsisters. Of course, they may always come to me in the event the problem is of a serious nature and cannot be resolved in any other way. But I have almost 500 disciples now, and it is impossible to be involved in their practical lives. I am confident the knowledge Srila Prabhupada has given us in his books, and which is repeated by me as their spiritual master, can solve my disciples' difficulties of material existence. But I know that my personal association is important. Therefore, following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada, I am traveling constantly. Friday, June 23rd. Today, as we drove for 3 hours from Chelyabinsk to Ekaterinburg for a Rath Yatra, the journey taking us through thick pine forests of central Russia. As we approached Ekaterinburg, I noticed many people picking the natural berries and fruits in the forest. This is one time of the year where the people have some opulence, Mother Nature providing sweet treats from her trees and bushes. It was a very hot day, and I noticed a resourcefulness amongst the poor people. They were wearing hats fashioned from leaves in the forest. Approaching the outskirts of Ekaterinburg, we came to a police roadblock. Cars were backed up as the police searched each and every vehicle. Seeing the situation, we were in anxiety that we wouldn't make the parade scheduled for 2 p.m., so we quickly drove alongside the traffic up to the front of the roadblock. Suddenly, two police officers approached our cars with AK-47s aimed directly at our heads, their fingers on the triggers. Apparently, we were making the wrong move at the wrong time. I thought, now we'll be here for hours. My disciple, Brihat Madungadas, jumped out and began talking to the officers. Suddenly their attitude changed and they waved us on without any search of the car. Amazed, I asked Brihat Madunga what he had said. I told him that saintly people were in the car with a holy father from the west. As we drove off, I noticed two army tanks taking position at the roadblock. The Rath Yatra was wonderful with more than 300 devotees participating. I got a chance to meet all the Gurukul children from Ekaterinburg, Gurukul, speaking at length with the 12 to 14-year-olds. Before returning to Chelyabinsk, I had accepted several as aspiring disciples. Saturday, June 24th. This morning, at Chelyabinsk, we received the most horrible news. The Rostov Temple, which we had visited just a few weeks ago, was attacked by 30 thugs. The attack had left 15 devotees in the hospital. The gang had entered the temple compound in 4 cars and 3 motorcycles at 7 p.m. while the devotees were attending Gaura Aarti. The temple is surrounded by a large wall, having previously been a kindergarten. There are only 2 ways to enter and exit the compound, and the thugs stationed men at each exit so devotees could not escape. After smashing all the cars in the driveway with sticks, they broke all the windows on the ground floor and entered the building. Most of the men were wearing black ski masks and helmets, and they all carried small wooden sticks with small, sharpened, shovel-like spades. They entered the kitchen and began attacking the men and women there with the sticks, beating two devotees unconscious and destroying most of the equipment in the kitchen. Before leaving, they sprayed the unconscious devotees with fire extinguishers. Then they went upstairs to the storage room where the books are kept and fractured the skull of one devotee and broke the arm of another. Anyone who assisted was beaten. Finding their way into the temple room, they beat the men and the women attending the ceremony. They tried to tear the sari off from one lady, screaming, "You are Russian. Why are you wearing these clothes?" Then they smashed the altar and threw the deities to the ground. The devotees were helpless. Acharyanidhi was knocked unconscious by a blow to the back of his head with a shovel. There was blood everywhere. Those devotees who managed to escape the building were beaten outside. After 20 minutes, the gang departed, leaving the temple a shambles. The police arrived shortly afterwards and apprehended five of the men who were found to be members of a local extremist political group. An investigation into the attack has begun, and the police have placed officers with machine guns around the temple to protect the devotees. The violence is getting extensive media coverage, and the devotees in Moscow have appealed to Parliament for an inquiry, criticizing a growing tendency in Russia towards religious intolerance. The incident has sent shockwaves to all the temples in Russia, as devotees fear the attack could be connected with the rumored crackdown by the government and that trouble may erupt elsewhere. Lord Nrsimhadev, please protect the devotees. Vidikshu dikshudam madar samam anta bahir bhagavan narasingaya prahapaya luka bayam svaneha sateja sagreshta samasta tejaha. Prahlad Maharaj loudly chanted the holy name of Lord Nrsimhadev. May Lord Nrsimhadev, roaring for his devotee Prahlad Maharaj, protect us from all fear of dangers created by stalwart leaders in all directions through poison, weapons, water, fire, air, and so on. May the Lord cover their influence by his own transcendental influence. May Lord Nrsimhadev protect us in all directions, in all corners, above, below, within, and without. Srimad Bhagavatam. I gave class later this morning, but found it difficult to concentrate with my mind on Rostov, and particularly on Acharyanidhi, Lord Chaitanya's soldier, who was lying in great pain in the hospital. It became clear to me that in the future, many sacrifices will have to be made to spread this movement. In the afternoon, we went to Chelyabinsk Airport to catch a flight back to Novosibirsk for their Rath Yatra. The city had officially invited the devotees to hold their Rath Yatra parade, along with other festivities for their annual city day. It was cool and rainy when we arrived back in Siberia, and the mosquitoes seemed more ferocious than ever. But the bright side was that His Holiness Prabhu Vishnuswami had arrived at the airport an hour earlier and was waiting for us at the temple. It had been more than 8 months since we had been together, and I was anxious to see Maharaj. We hurried to the temple and went upstairs to his room, where we exchanged obeisances and loving embraces. As traveling preachers, we all have our responsibilities, often in isolated areas, and as such, we don't often get the association of God brothers. But when we do, there is a camaraderie that is difficult to express as we exchange stories of our preaching experiences. Saturday, June 25th. In the morning, it seemed as though we would have to do the Rath Yatra in coats and hats, but the weather changed by midday, and we had a wonderful parade to the center of the city, which was packed with people participating in the festivities. The beautiful Rath Yatra cart, carrying the colorfully dressed Jagannath deities, accompanied by a blissful kirtan group of 400 dancing devotees, was a sharp contrast to the mode of ignorance that prevailed the city. The people's attempt to enjoy the city day festivities consisted mainly of walking the streets drinking beer and vodka, while occasionally dancing to the various bands that played along the way. The city of Novosibirsk is old, gray, and dilapidated, and most buildings need dire repair. The Siberian people are a tough lot, having to live much of the year in extreme weather conditions. It often goes below 50 degrees in the winter, and the summers are short and cool. As our kirtan party passed, the people stood in amazement while the devotees revealed the color, joy, and festivity of the spiritual world. In the afternoon, we performed kirtan and spoke from a small stage provided by the festival organizers. The local devotees also presented a show by their transcendental rock band. In the crowd, I saw the face of a young lady who had been present along with her friends when we had first arrived at the Novosibirsk temple last week. During that reception, she had been standing outside with her friends, laughing and making fun of the devotees. I assumed she was from the neighborhood and that the reception had attracted the attention of her group. At one point, the devotees asked them to leave and stop making so much trouble, but she returned a few minutes later with another girl and continued to watch the chanting and dancing, this time in a more submissive mood. Though she was unkempt and dressed in dirty jeans and shirt, I motioned to her to come into the temple. Flabbergasted that I would suggest such a thing, she recoiled, but an hour later, the kirtan was still roaring, and I invited her in again. This time, she shyly entered and stood at the back of the room, her mouth and eyes wide open as she watched the devotees chanting and dancing in ecstasy. Somehow, she had become irresistibly attracted to the chanting, which was having a purifying effect on her. After that, I didn't see her again, but the image of the rapid change that had come over her remained. Now she was in the crowd watching us again. I pressed forward to look closer, and lo and behold, I saw she was dressed in a sari, a big smile on her face, chanting and dancing with the devotees. I couldn't believe my eyes. She also recognized me as the one who had encouraged her to join the kirtan a few days earlier. She smiled at me, and as I offered her one of the garments I was wearing, she folded her hands in pranam, thanking me in return. How quickly she had been delivered from the ocean of material existence and had given up her old ways. One of my favorite verses by Śrīla Rūpa Gosvāmī immediately came to mind. Now that we have become devotees, your holy names have affectionately created a jubilant festival within our mouths. Your bodily splendor, like a dark rain cloud, has become the black ointment of our eyes, and the music of your flute has become the ornament of our ears. We no longer take pleasure in material desires. O Almighty Lord, material desires no longer appear beautiful to us. Monday, June 26. Today, Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj left to continue his visit to Central Asia. Govinda Maharaj flew back to Western Europe, and Sri Prahlad and I flew to Moscow. It was difficult having to separate from Govinda Maharaj. We had been through so much together during the past 2 months. Friendship in Krishna consciousness is based on service to the Supreme Lord. And because the service is profound, being of a transcendental nature, so are the relationships profound between devotees who serve Krishna together. There's nothing I wouldn't do for Maharaj, and I'm sure he feels the same towards me. Such a relationship is rare in this world, and I cherish his friendship very much. Although myself and Sri Prahlad will spend a day and a half in Moscow, I'm thinking of Poland in preparation for our summer tour beginning next week. By Krishna's grace, I have several good men in Poland who organize the festival tours while I am traveling and preaching outside the country. In particular, Amritananda Das works diligently in my absence to assure the tour is properly arranged before I return. We speak by phone several times a week from wherever I am in the world. Recently, he has informed me that the anti-cult people in Poland have stepped up their offensive against us with negative articles appearing in the press. Several unfavorable TV programs have also appeared. I had always hoped it would never happen in Poland, because the preaching is especially nectarian and sweet there. But those envious of our success cannot tolerate us any longer, and they are poisoning the minds of the people with false charges and accusations. So I feel as if I am going from one battlefield to another. The pressure is on from all sides. But I suppose we have to expect such fights, because after all, this is the material world, and the devotees and asuras have been at odds with each other since time immemorial. We are at the forefront of a great spiritual renaissance in society, as predicted by Lord Chaitanya 500 years ago, when he said the chanting of Hare Krishna would be heard in every town and village in the world. Srila Prabhupada also shed light on ISKCON's role in the future when he said to Gurudas in London in 1971, quote, "This movement will save the world in its darkest hour." Unquote. There may be difficult times ahead, as indicated by the recent events in Russia and Poland, but if we take shelter of Krishna, we will most certainly be victorious. Srila Prabhupada says, quote, "If the preachers in our Krishna conscious movement are sincere devotees of Krishna, Krishna will always be with them, because he is very kind and favorable to all his devotees. Just as Arjuna and Krishna were victorious in the battle of Kurukshetra, this Krishna conscious movement will surely emerge victorious if we but remain sincere devotees of the Lord and serve the Lord according to the advice of predecessors, the six Goswamis and other devotees of the Lord. If we attempt this seriously within the society, it will be successfully done. There is no question of estimating how this will happen in the mundane sense, but without a doubt, it happens by the grace of Krishna. Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila Purport 479, the end. Shri Prabhupada ki, Hariman Sen Kirtan Yagya ki, Nitai Goa Premanande Hare Krishna. Prasadam ki, Kadasi ki. Okay, Prasadam. Does we have prasadam for everybody? Or? Yes? Okay. Where's Pallad? Oh. You want to have a little kirtan first? A little kirtan? Got a harmonium here?
Yes.
Definitely. Jai Dev Prabhu ki. I want to keep the devotees starving. Okay. Well, where is it? Now that we've taken the decision.